the more frequently you can train aerobically, the better. And you know, I'd say there's no such thing as sort of too slow or I mean, maybe not exactly too short, but, you know, 20 or 30 minutes is still going to add up.
The Triathlon Show, 172. Hey, what's up, everybody, and welcome back to another episode of That Triathlon Show, the podcast presented by scientifictriathlon.com. I'm your host, Michael, and on today's episode, I have a really, really amazing interview in store for you. I'm super excited. It's with Coach Joel Filial, who is one of the most successful elite triathlon coaches in the history of the sport, I think it's safe to say. He has his own multinational squad of elite athletes that he coaches. Currently, some of the most well-known names in that squad include world champion Mario Mola, world number two Katie Zafiris, world number two Vincent Louis, Jake Burfwhistle, Martin Van Riel, and others. And in the past, he has coached athletes like, for example, Simon Whitfield, who took the Olympic silver medal in Beijing 2008 while being coached by Joel. Joel is also currently working as the Olympic Performance Director for the Italian Triathlon Federation, and in the past he has worked as the head coach for British Triathlon, and in that role worked with, among others, athletes like the Brownlee brothers, and he has worked in various roles for Triathlon Canada as well. Before we get into the interview, big thanks to today's sponsors. First, we have Precision Hydration. And as you've heard probably many times already, when we talk about hydration, it's not just about fluid replacement, but sodium replacement as well, because that plays a critical role. And the interesting thing is that the difference in the amount of sodium that people lose in their sweat can be quite huge. Some people might lose 200 milligrams of sodium per liter of sweat, and some people might lose over 2,000 milligrams. And then when you consider that people can have different sweat rates, then you see that these differences and individual considerations, they add up very, very quickly. And that's why Precision Hydration, they have positioned themselves to not just provide the products, the hydration products and the sodium replacement products, but also provide the knowledge and the consultancy to allow you to get to know more about how you should hydrate. So what they did was they created a free online sweat test that is based on a great amount of actual sweat test data with medical grade equipment. And this free sweat test has been validated against that. And you can just quickly answer 10 questions or so in an online quiz and get a very good estimate for how much you sweat and how much sodium you lose in your sweat. And of course, you get a free hydration strategy as a result, and this will allow you to tackle your next race, being very prepared and knowing what to do when it comes to hydration. If you want to try Precision Hydration's hydration products, use the promo code THATTRIATHLONSHOW, all one word, all caps, to get your first box for free on precisionhydration.com. And of course, before you do that, take that free online sweat test to know which electrolyte strength you should go for. And a big thanks to Roka that you can find on roka.com. Roka is the world leading manufacturer in triathlon apparel, wetsuits, and performance eyewear. They invest a lot in R&D, and one of the main victories of that R&D is the Arms Up technology that they created for their wetsuits, which results in greater flexibility and mobility on the swim than with any other wetsuit. And this Arms Up technology exists in all of their wetsuits, from the entry level to the very high-end wetsuits. But interestingly, they also use a modified Arms Up technology in their triathlon suits, because when they thought that, hey, if we're actually using a tri-suit, or we wear a tri-suit under the wetsuit, so if that tri-suit restricts mobility, then maybe that wetsuit mobility doesn't count for as much. So they added that modified Arms Up technology to the tri-suits as well, to make sure that you have no restrictions from that aspect. So when you use a Roka wetsuit and a tri-suit, you can be sure that your mobility is going to be excellent and your swim is not going to be restricted by mobility or flexibility. This sort of performance thinking and really striving for excellence is present in all of Roka's products. And that's why I think that they're such a great company, and I really admire what they do and all their products. You can get 20% off your entire order on Roka.com or their EU or UK websites that you can navigate to from that Roka.com main page with the promo code THATTRIATHLONSHOW, all one word, all caps. So the interview today is quite long. It is in fact very long compared to what they usually are, but it's as long as it needed to be, not a second longer. So enjoy this great chat and all the fantastic advice that you will get from Coach Joel Filial. Today's guest on That Triathlon Show is Joel Filial. Joel, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you, and it's also great to have you perhaps back with your own podcast, the Real Coaching Podcast, which I enjoyed while it was going on a couple of years ago, and now you've done a couple of episodes again. So I guess you can tell us a bit what's the plan with that podcast going forward. Are you going to continue to do that regularly?
Yeah, certainly it's my intention. I've enjoyed doing it, and had some good interaction and questions, and like anything like that, it gets you to think about different topics. So it's got a personal interest as well as sharing information about what we're doing and how I think about the sport.
Yeah, definitely. And actually, a lot of the topics that I have for today are from an episode that you did, which was basically a Q&A episode with a lot of questions. And many of these questions are things that stood out to me from your answers to those questions. So let's just start with the first thing that I noted here, which was that you really emphasize keeping things simple and avoiding major mistakes. So can you talk a little bit about that and how that's a big part of your philosophy?
Yeah, I think, you know, in the proliferation of information and sports science and just the evolution of a young sport like triathlon, you might argue in general in the world today, we have so much information. And I think, you know, being able to filter that and to understand what's important is key. You know, finding wisdom in this data, in this information, and all of the choices that we have to make. What do we pay attention to? What's really important? And what's not, what are distractions? And I feel like this concept of keeping simple has never been more relevant than now, of, you know, what actually makes a difference, what is like a distraction, what can you implement consistently over time as a coach or as an athlete, what has real value. So I keep coming back to that, trying to filter what's really important. And it's not easy. We're surrounded by new technology. The ability to measure things has never been easier. The ability to collect data has never been easier. And finding really the value is probably never been harder than now. And so, I remind myself and in my daily work, you know, what are the essentials here? What's important? And so I come back to that concept of keeping it simple. And there's a tendency to want to make things, you know, appear sophisticated. And we maybe get a go along with some of the other points in the discussion. But that keeping
simple. Well, if you want to give a couple of examples, or even just one example of something that you think that today is, I guess, becoming popular or getting riding the hype curve, so to say. Do you have any examples of that that you want to point out?
Well, probably the one that immediately comes to mind is athlete monitoring or workload monitoring and what's real there. And I suppose it's always useful to think about, well, what context are you working in as a coach? Because not everyone is working in the same context. So there are, you know, perhaps different tools you might use in different contexts. But what I always come back to is you know, paying attention to the athletes and their mood, how they're behaving kind of every day. You know, I watch them walking to the pool. I watch their joking around and laughing. And so I have that everyday context that perhaps not everyone has if you're working remotely or you're not sort of on deck. But paying attention to that stuff, you know, is really effective. And we've seen this in even when it's been, you know, various athlete monitoring, recovery monitoring. None of this stuff is particularly new. You know, we can go back to, you know, measuring, you know, morning heart rate and, you know, what did we have when it was simpler, when we had more simple tools, to more sophisticated tools now. But, you know, what seems to be just really effective is asking athletes how they're doing. How do they feel? What's, you know, do they have any soreness? Are they tired? You know, this just really simple stuff of interacting with people, I think is still the most effective. And this is borne out in various ways that you can measure this, if it's possible to measure this.
And I guess to be clear for the listeners, I think that you refer to things like, for example, measuring a chronic training load and things like that, and perhaps HRV and other sort of measurables, and those are the things that are perhaps overcomplicating things versus asking the athlete how they feel. Just to make things concrete for the listeners, are those a couple of examples of what you consider workload monitoring?
Yeah, I mean, I think my first thought was about recovery monitoring. So, you know, various ways to measure that from, you know, there's all kinds of ways you can measure that. But, you know, HRV is one more, you know, technological way to look at that. Like I said, morning heart rate, or, you know, even questionnaires, or, you know, apps asking how they're feeling. You know, even in one really interesting and very simple way, in Training Peaks is sort of the application Training Peaks is the implementation of this sort of RPE thing, which is just a emoticon. And like the beautiful simplicity of that, you know, you get a smiley face or a sad face, and actually it's pretty useful, you know, as a data point. But of course, what's really interesting in my work is seeing the athletes in person and talking to them, you know, so that I think that's never going to go out of style. I mean, you always want to find other ways of understanding how they are, but mood and body language and just general their perception of their energy is a holistic way to look at where they're at. I think where you're going also, you know, with measuring workload, I differentiate that to kind of readiness to train and recovery. Workload, we've got, you know, a ton of ways to measure that, and accessibility that we never used to have. But then, of course, we generate significant amounts of data with that. And you know, I find myself still kind of coming back to really just simple metrics of, you know, hours, time spent. Obviously, it doesn't have the fine detail of the type of work done, but at a glance, it's still pretty effective. Just for even the simple reason that our technology is not terribly reliable at the point yet. You know, I mean, GPS is pretty consistent, although obviously the athlete has to remember to wear their devices or charge them. But you know, even power, you know, I've got, I mean, on any given day, somebody's power meter is not working. And so, you know, here we are, you know, it's 2019 and, you know, a lot of this stuff, I mean, I suppose technology in general isn't always reliable or rock solid. And, you know, as soon as you introduce holes in your data, you know, stuff like the chronic training load, you know, where you got to pay attention. Is it correct? Is it close enough? Is it, you know, how many holes are in there? Glitches, you know, that takes a lot of attention to understand if, you know, how accurate is, how useful is it even. You know, we might take a look at chronic training load, of course, and have the understanding of how we can put data together over time and understand, you know, acute and chronic, and, you know, that the balance between those. But I, you know, I find myself coming back to, you know, how many Ks did we do? How many hours did we do? Does that get us the essentials? And often, I think it does. It doesn't tell us always all the quality, but I find, it's still pretty good keeping it simple in that way.
Yeah. And especially when you have that, that relationship with the athlete, and you know what kind of training that you're giving them. So you know whether you're giving 15 hours a week of that's perhaps not for you with the elite squad, let's say 30 hours per week of easier training, or if it's 25 hours of pretty intense training. So you already have that context of the intensity, I guess, the intensity profile of the training. If somebody is coming to you cold and saying that they do, you know nothing about them, and they say that I'll train 25 hours a week, that's perhaps not not going to directly tell you what how much that really is, or how hard that workload is. But when you have the context of being the coach of the athlete, then it absolutely hours is really fundamental. And as you say, for various reasons, it's less sensitive to errors than the other sources of workload.
It's interesting when you just say that. It made me think of, you know, when I look at an athlete's program, if they say, let's say they say they do 30 hours a week. There's different kinds of 30 hours a week, but you can tell by looking how much time are they inputting for like swim sessions, for example. You know, I've seen the 2 hour 5K swims or the 1 hour 15 5K swims. You know, how much, you know, if you're doing that six times a week and you're adding an extra 30 to 45 minutes every time, that's probably not reality, then it's easy to pad those numbers, or how much, you know, gym time is actually workload versus, you know, sitting down on a mat, for example. But yeah, you could, you know, it doesn't take too long to dig into context. And you know, I mean, the question that when I think about, so how many weeks did you do X hours? You know, that's more interesting to me than you know, the one-offs. So as you say, when you dig into the context, you can start to see what's going on. But, you know, if somebody tells me they're training consistently at 30 hours a week, I've got an idea of what they're doing in any case. And it, you know, it automatically says something about the training load that they're doing. It's not a fine detail, but I mean, again, the question is like, what's enough detail to make decisions, and how deep do you need to dig in order to understand, you know, what to do, what decisions to make, how to proceed. But as you said, the context with, if you're actually coaching these athletes, then, you know, then all of these points mean something, and you learn to understand what to pay attention to.
Yeah. And for a self-coach athlete, hopefully they have a grasp of their own context as well, because a lot of the listeners, of course, are self-coach athletes. So then that just goes to say that, yeah, I mean, those simple traditional things like hours and kilometers are not to be snuffed at. Let's talk about go a bit deeper, I guess, into workload, because that's another point that I heard you make about consistent total workload over time and across disciplines being one of, if not the biggest factor behind improvement in endurance sports. So can you talk about that?
Yeah, I mean, I guess it's a good segue from where we just were. You know, I think in endurance sport, I think because of the ability to measure things outside of the lab, and you know, we essentially have mobile ergometers on our bikes, and we've got, you know, data from every run that we do now. It's things have trended towards, I think, more focus on intensity, and you could probably say this even across sports. And as we've understood, you know, the impact of intensity and the you know, even more in triathlon, the specificity of intensity, there's been this focus on that, you know, focus on sort of key workouts, you know, quote unquote key workouts. What are your key workouts? And trying to understand even the whole concept of key workouts, you might say, is a misnomer. There's no such thing as really a key workout that is unlocks the program or unlocks success. But in fact, it's, you know, my view and my experience, it's that workload over time, or that chronic training load over time, is a big driver ultimately your success in achieving your potential. And, you know, underpinning that, it's the volume and frequency that is the biggest impact. You know, I'll take an athlete who primarily trains, you know, easy, but with relatively high volume and frequency, over, you know, a reverse to that of fairly high intensity but lower volume. I think we can't escape, I guess a critical volume, if you like, over time as a driver of a aerobic endurance sport. Yes, we know that it's the impacts of, you know, high intensity training and race pace training, but we also, how I see it, is you can only do so much of that, and if it's not underpinned by frequent easy training, frequent low intensity training over time, then, you know, that, I guess I think of it as like a foundation underneath. I mean, maybe a quite traditional aerobic base way of thinking about it, but, you know, I think actually that's the fundamental thing that we're trying to do. And, you know, it's, you started by asking, you know, major mistakes, and it's relating to keeping things simple. And I think the major error that we all tend towards because of the variety of factors which you might talk about, including ego, is just about intensity, and then overdoing intensity and overdoing race pace sessions and overdoing race specificity. It's tempting to think about the most direct route, you know, to getting where we want to go, or at least it intuitively may seem like that, in the most specific way. If you want to get better at, you know, running whatever pace for your 10K, then you should practice running that pace more often. But actually, that's perhaps not the best way. And certainly, you know, what I've come to understand is the higher intensities have, you know, there's a tolerance to how much you can do, and you might even say a toxicity to too much. You know, too much makes you ill, or makes you, you know, has a negative impact. And so, you know, I think even when we're thinking self-coached or even recreational, like age group or serious age group, you know, compared to elite, you know, there's still a maximum tolerance. You know, the elites don't necessarily do massively more intensity or volume of race-specific intensity or faster than race pace. They don't necessarily do any more. You know, there's a certain amount you can do and recover from, and it's the rest of the training that's then kind of interesting, is how much volume can you consistently do while you're doing race intensity or higher intensity, and how much of that do you do? But, you know, I always come back to, you know, frequency, consistent volume over time. And that just means to me, you know, first building up, you know, how many times you're training per week in each sport, mostly easy, build the total volume, mostly easy, start to add work like hills and lower intensity, lower than race pace. I think you can do a lot with under race pace or under threshold, which, however you think about various thresholds, you can do a lot with going under. You don't need to do a lot over. But it's so tempting to want to do those high intensity sessions, but maybe to demonstrate to yourself that you're getting fitter, or to prove to yourself or test yourself. But of course, the irony there is if you do too much testing, you inevitably compromise your chronic training load. So you're actually compromising that consistency.
Yeah. And I also think another reason that that high intensity is so popular is that it's fairly simple to study compared to, for example, low intensity, high volume training over a long time. That would be very difficult to study in comparison to a 6-week interval training program. So that might be another thing there. When you mentioned the critical threshold of volume, how do you have an idea of what that might be for somebody who is looking to be, because you're working obviously with elite ITU draft legal athletes, so for that demographic, what do you see as the critical threshold of volume? Is it can you say anything about that?
Yeah, I mean, I guess it's not a precise figure, no. But and I would say even there's a range of what you might consider highly successful individuals are doing, and actually there was a presentation at the INSEP conference. It was put on by the ITU a few years ago in Paris, and I think all of these presentations may be online, although I'm not sure this one is. This was by Sergio Santos, a Portuguese coach, and he compared the training weeks of a number of different programs and athletes. And it was interesting because most of them were fairly similar. You know, over or under 30 hours, you might say that, the low end might be 25 hours per week, and the high end might be 35 hours per week. So that's already a pretty big range. But the sweet spot being in there, depending how much intensity you use, really, I think that ends up being what how much you can do is going to depend a lot on that. The first thing to fall away when you're fatigued is you can't do the intensity that you want. So, you might find this could be an interesting point for development of athletes is, should you prioritize doing the race pace intensity or the volume? Because young athletes, you tend to find they can't do both. So what can they do compared to senior athletes? They can do one or the other, not usually both at the same time. And that's ultimately the differentiator. When a new athlete comes to a program, typically they if they haven't done the volume, then they're going to struggle to be able to do that. But what we would see is they would not be able to do the intensity as well through the week and months as a more senior athlete. So the senior athletes can recover from the general volume and be able to be consistent. So, but coming back to that, like that concept of a critical volume, that I don't know if that's that helpful to think of it in that way. But yeah, it's going to range. Probably not too many top level endurance, even in, well, I, short course in Ironman doesn't, I don't think, differentiate that much in volume, but it's probably not too many less than 24 hours, per week. And of course, we're talking somewhat consistently. It's not going to be every week all year. But over time, how many of those weeks are you stacking together, as a sense of that volume? And I think if you're too low on that side, if you get below that 24, 25 hours, too many weeks in the year, I think you may have issues achieving your ultimate potential. And I think you need a certain amount of that. And we saw this kind of discussion in athletics over the last 20 years that, we've seen kind of a swing from, a lot of speed work back to volume. I mean, it maybe started more on the volume side and, the traditional sort of 100 miles a week or above. But then it swung to kind of the trend, if you like, to being more focused on high intensity. And now it's probably the pendulum has swung back a little bit more towards volume. But in triathlon is a much younger sport and maybe more diverse than just distance running. We've got all kinds of disciplines and just not a long history. So, but yeah, coming back to that, like I think, even when it comes to what do we mean by consistency? And I was talking with a colleague today about consistency. I think everyone says consistency is important, but the word has perhaps lost its meaning or any kind of understanding. What does that even mean? What does it mean to be consistent? What are we really talking about? And at least how I think about it is the workload that we can sustain week after week without taking recovery weeks. That's what I'm looking for. We've been here since the beginning of January. The middle of February. Yeah. Right. We've not taken a recovery week and we're not going to take a recovery week. And the weeks that the workload that I want to do to be consistent has got to be sustainable over a long period of time. So we don't follow a periodization like, you know, the 1, 2, 3, 1 week off, that kind of stuff. In my experience, and I've done all of that before, of course, as you develop and try different ways of periodizing training and understanding workload, you know, certainly practiced all that. But I found if you're desperately needing the recovery week, you know, in any kind of periodization, or even in the shorter ones, if you're doing a 3 days in 1, if you're really desperately needing that 1 day or 1 week, the training, the workload on those days is probably too high, and you're not going to be able to do that consistently. You know, again, what can you do sustainably? And it, of course, it doesn't mean that we don't adapt, and that some athletes don't end up needing recovery to be adapted. We change the program if they need it, but the goal is to try to make the workload consistent over that time. And the biggest impact of that is how much and the type of intensity that we do. The more intensity that we do, the more likely that we're going to lose that consistency, because if we overshoot a little bit, then it's going to affect what they can do the following days. And I mean, this isn't like a formula that ever you totally figure out. I mean, it's a constant thing that's in flux all the time. You can overshoot one session and you know, try to learn from that and make a better decision in the moment the next time. There's not generally a problem with underdoing it. It's not, you know, the cost of underdoing workload either in a specific session or over time is not a catastrophic problem. But of course, the opposite is a catastrophic problem. And so when we come back to, you know, this consistency, what we're trying to avoid as well is interruptions in training due to illness and injury. And short-term fatigue is just, you know, part of that, trying to avoid the, you know, heavy short-term fatigue. But that's what we're trying to avoid. And then that's the biggest killer of progression over time is when you're forced to take time off due to training error, and almost everything is training error. You know, we come back to, you know, basically all injuries that are not an acute event like crashing your bike or another, you know, accident type thing are training load errors. And some people have, due to their biomechanics, have lower thresholds of tolerance, and others much higher, but it's still you exceeded whatever tissue's ability to take the load, or your, you know, in another case, it could be, you know, immunity issues as well related to general stress from training or otherwise. So, you know, that's what we're trying to be able to do. And as I say, I don't think you ever have it totally figured out. We're constantly tweaking and adjusting and monitoring and watching and listening and being willing to adapt. You know, this, I guess that's the coaching practice, if you like. You have to practice that, because ultimately the decision making, the daily decision making, is what coaching is about. The physiology and all that's not so difficult. The decision making is hard, or it's harder to tread the line of, you know, what's the right thing. You know, when do you push on? When do you back off? You know, when is enough, and when is too much, and you know, that takes time to develop that, and of course you have to understand the athletes. So I think the better we get at that, the more likely we're actually going to be consistent and have the least interruptions, and then ultimately that's going to give us the most predictable performance, I think.
Yeah. Well, that was a fantastic answer to the question, and a lot of really, really golden nuggets in there. I think the one follow-up that I will ask is, do you have any particular consideration that for age group athletes that are not training 25, 30 hours per week, that they should take from this whole discussion, and how they apply it, I guess, in their lives and their training?
Well, the first thing that comes to me is just frequency. You know, the more frequently you can train aerobically, the better. And you know, I'd say there's no such thing as sort of too slow or I mean, maybe not exactly too short, but you know, 20 or 30 minutes is still going to add up. You know, I don't think there's any issue. You know, if you can fit in a 20-minute run, that's what you can do, then, and you can add that in, then, you know, build towards that. I just think frequency for, you know, from the point of view of when you're getting fit, frequency is just really powerful. And the more you can do of that, like, you know, and just easy frequency, that is a starting point. You know, when I'm thinking about anybody's, you know, current fitness level, what's the next step is often just to add frequency, then volume, then intensity. And intensity is just the least important, I think, of those. Of course, when you've got some race goals, you've got to progress towards, you know, being able to do the duration and do it at the pace you want. But you know, it doesn't have to be all specific. And I think starting point with, you know, wherever you are now, you can probably add some frequency, and that can help. You know, you don't necessarily need a day off, for example, or multi, you know, or more than one day off aerobic exercise. You can do something every day, and I think, I mean, we apply this with our elite athletes. Is I prefer to spread out the training over the week rather than have particular days off. And that can be effective for anyone, you know, rather than try to do the same volume in 6 days, we can do it over 7 days or, you know, or whatever breakdown is applicable to the individual, but to spread things out a little bit more. And, you know, again, a starting point can be to add frequency.
Yeah, yeah. A little bit of back of the napkin math, 3 times a week, an extra 20-minute workout. That adds up to 50 hours per year or more, 52. So that's significant for age group athletes. That can be around 10%, I guess, of the yearly volume that you can add from 3 more 20-minute sessions per week. So the next thing that I wanted to discuss is how to approach the lower intensity sessions, which, as we talked about, are super important now. So what's your take on that?
Yeah, I mean, they got to be as slow as they need to be, and I don't think there's really such thing as too slow. Again, there are some athletes that they're, you know, the most, I guess the error that you see is that their easy stuff is too fast, and there's all kinds of different reasons for that. Some of it is because we can measure it, and so you're looking at the pace, it can be. People, you know, now that you can look down at your watch and you can see exactly what pace per K or per mile you're going, then it's tempting to want to increase that. But we go as slow as we need to go. And, you know, that can mean some pretty slow running. Riding, again, it's the error of too slow is not terribly significant when you're training higher frequency and higher volume. So, you know, RPE, yep, go by RPE, go as easy as you want to go, as easy as the body wants to go. Sometimes we have to tell people to slow down, but it's, I don't think I would ever tell somebody to speed up an easy session. So yeah, that's how we do it. Most of our guys, even the very, very fast runners are, you know, they're running 4:30s, 5 minutes per K for easy runs, sometimes slower, depending who they are or how tired you are. And, you know, again, I think there's no such thing as sort of jump miles in this way. It's just all aerobic training. And if you need to go slower, go slower.
Yeah. So I want to highlight that because that's super important to hear that these guys that are running 28 minutes off the bike in an Olympic distance triathlon, they are running their easy runs at 4:32 to 5 minute pace per kilometer. That would be, I guess, 7:15, 8 minute mile pace for the Imperial listeners. So so that's something to keep in mind. And I think that another important thing that you mentioned there is that you run by or train by RPE as low as needed. I actually just recently had this discussion with one of my athletes and told him to like don't have the watch on a display that shows pace or anything like that. Just go by RPE. Make sure that the RPE is really low. Is really easy because we consistently had some issues with too fast and too fast paces, too high powers in easy training. So I think that's important to hear and highlight as well. Are there differences between the disciplines? I guess running and cycling you already alluded to seem pretty similar. What about swimming? Do you have swim sessions that are completely easy, complete recovery, or how does that differ in any way?
Yeah. I mean, I guess the difference in swimming is the technical side of things. You know, how is the stroke perhaps different if you're going really easy or really slow? But in the end, yeah, of course, we do easy swimming and we mix the strokes only a little bit in the warm up. But in general, you know, if we want to swim easier, we might put the pool buoy in or you know, use pulling, and depending the amount of pulling that they're used to. But our guys are capable of pulling every day multiple kilometers. And I find that's a good way when the fatigue is high to go pull paddles, and you tend to have slightly better mechanics. It's the extra feedback of pressure on the hand keeps the elbow up and the armpit open a little bit more. And this is the interesting part about triathlon is the interaction between the three sports. And of course the swim for most of the athletes that we're dealing with, and most of the athletes in the sport, you might describe them low efficiency swimmers. And when they're fatigued, they slow down, their mechanics are worse, their technique is worse. And this is where using various tools to help that process can make a big difference. The flotation body position from a pool buoy can make a difference, and allow you to do a little bit more volume with better techniques. So you have to build up to that, to be able to use pool paddles without any issues. But eventually you can, you know, we have some athletes that do 90% of their swimming pool paddles. And others where there's a mix. It depends if they're kind of more kick dominant swimmer from their rhythm or not. But yeah, that so it is. I guess it's different in that way.
Is that 90% of their total swimming or 90% of the volume in an easier session that you mean?
That's a back of the napkin calculation, but it's basically yeah of total swimming. It depends. You know. The factor is, you know, ideally we want to have good quality swimming under high fatigue levels, and that's tricky. That's not easy to do, and that's where the tools can be useful for in order to, I guess, take more good strokes versus more if you think of the traditional sort of, you know, closed armpit, dropped elbow kind of, you know, low propulsion swimming. This is where the tools come into play in order to have better quality swimming. But that's the one thing I've really kind of been thinking about more in the last 4 or 5 years is the interaction between the three and depending. I mean, I suppose a lot of age group and long course, the swim, I mean, you put the wetsuit on and you can, you know, you've got to have the endurance to get through it, but it's not, you know, the make or break part of the race. Obviously for professionals and faster and long course, it is very important. You need to make the train. And then in Olympic racing, it's absolutely critical. And so the balance of workload between the three sports is something to play with and observe and watch, what you did the day before, how fatigued the legs are. You know, it can make such a difference in the quality that you get, both quality of output and quality, technical quality can just vary so much based on fatigue. So again, the shortcut around that, if you like, it's not a shortcut really, but is to use the pull paddle tools to just swim technically better more often, even under heavy fatigue.
And do you have some other things that you've practically started to apply in training based on what you've discovered and found out about the interaction of the different disciplines?
Yeah, I mean the microcycle template, how you manage between, you know, where are your key runs and bikes, although we tend to follow the same more or less anyway, but we tend to not train very early in the morning, for example. And I know some athletes' neuromuscular coordination and their just general swimming don't function very early in the morning. I mean, we kind of know from the circadian rhythm that there's sort of better periods of the day, although you can't always pick that according to that reason. But yeah, we've played around with the loading the day before where we want to swim with do a harder swim and try to protect for some athletes the quality of their output in the water. It's not an easy thing because, again, we come back to where we started the conversation, consistent workload over time. You know, certainly at the top level, there's a level of fatigue, a general level of fatigue that just stays there. It's just omnipresent, they're always a certain level of fatigued. So they're never really fresh when we're in a training block. Which can be tricky for improving swimming. We need to be aware of that. So, you know, we can manipulate the total volume, particularly running. Running seems to have the higher run volume seems to have the most impact on swimming quality. So if you want to, I mean, and we know this intuitively as well when, if you want to see somebody improve their swim, or you want to by accident anyway, if somebody's got a running injury, usually they can't run as much or at all, often their swimming immediately gets better. And that's just also a function of total training load going down. And of course your quality goes up in everything that you do. But just that interaction between, the goal. So if you've got somebody that needs to improve their swimming, then you might modify their workload on the bike and run to be a little bit less than what they might otherwise do to have, more energy for swimming. And even just paying attention to what I was saying before about, do they swim better in the morning or the afternoon? And perhaps if you can, choosing a, it's most likely going to be the afternoon if they're highly fit. They might feel the water, feel better neuromuscularly in the afternoon than the morning, but depends what else you're doing. Don't want it to be a cop out of saying it depends all the time, but it does about the training load and what's normal. Some athletes can do, say 100K ride in the morning and go in the afternoon and crank out a great 5K swim, and another would be destroyed if they did that and they wouldn't get any swimming quality. So again, it varies over time and comes back to, the big differentiator across athletes is, what kind of intensity they can do under heavy fatigue and under high chronic load.
Yeah. I've played around with this and changed it after the new year that now I do my swimming in the afternoon and I tend to do my bikes and runs as the primary session, I guess, because for me, my limiter for 70.3 racing, which is now my main focus, is not swim, but it's really the run that I really want to focus on improving a lot. And I find that when I do a 5K swim, even if it's not like the hardest in the world, it really takes away from my running quality in the afternoon. But if I do it the other way around, I can still get a good session in usually in the pool in the afternoon, even if I have done a hard run. And if it's an easy run, then it's no problem at all. So yeah, I guess that's an example of how playing around with the interactions between disciplines can play out. But as you say, it does depend on what the strengths and weaknesses of the athlete are and what the objective and the main things to improve are as well.
Yeah, go ahead.
The next thing that I had here to discuss would be the high intensity sessions and approaching them. If you can cover that the way that you sort of covered off the low intensity sessions.
Yeah, I guess I think about this a lot all the time as well. And one of the interesting things of the ability to share information and know what the world is doing that you couldn't do 10 or 20 years ago. We tend to focus a lot on the speed of sessions and see what others are doing. And for me, I think I see an overemphasis on over race pace work. And I guess, coming back to the context of my everyday is the Olympic pathway work and the Olympic distance. So 5K, 10K, perhaps it might apply slightly less over longer distance, but just the biggest mistake I see so much is so often is just speeds and intensity that are just far too much, particularly with running, far too fast. It seemed like disconnected from anything the athletes will ever face in a competition. One interesting thing about triathlon running is because we do it in a pre-fatigue state coming off of the bike, that the speeds that even the best in the world are doing are attainable sort of by all, you know, that we're not limited by the ability to run, you know, for the 99% anyway, are not limited in the ability to run the speed. It's to be fit enough to run it under fatigue and resistant to slowing down is the more the reality. Even the very best men and the women in the world in Olympic distance or shorter, the speeds that they're going at any point in a 5K or 10K are attainable by athletes of a much lower performance level. And yet, if you look at, you know, the sort of infamous track session, track Tuesdays that are around the world that we saw yesterday, you know, many, many of those athletes will be going far over race pace, far faster than anything that they'll face in racing. And for me, my thought on that is just the amount of risk that you're taking on board when you're exceeding either from a fitness point of view your biomechanical limits or just how much stress you're putting on your system and what is the return on that. Obviously to some degree, you know, there's a, you know, the training stress and response is a continuum. So you can have, you know, it's not, don't need to go at a precise pace to get a precise response. It doesn't exactly work like that. But, you know, I just see athletes in general running far too fast. And it's just, I think the risk is just really high when you're doing that. And, you know, biomechanically, you know, the biggest problems we're going to have are breakdown of biomechanics and injury and
where does the problem lie? Is it in the programming that coaches are prescribing the sessions as 10x400 maximum sustainable pace, mm-hmm. or is it that the athletes want to push themselves? What do you think?
It's both of those things. You know, I think where is the starting point? I guess it might be from a different understanding of what triathlon running is. You know, it's not about the speed, quote unquote speed. It's about endurance and fitness and conditioning. What is the route to get there? You know, if your goal is running 3 minutes a K off a bike, how much time do you need to spend running substantially over that? You know, I mean, that's an interesting question to think about. You know, but mostly I see it just a disconnection from reality, you know, dream paces, not reality paces, you know, dream intensities, not reality paces. I think if you want to become a 3 minutes per K off the bike runner and you're currently 3:15, you don't get there by running a bunch of 3 minutes per K because that's the wrong intensity for you with your current fitness level. It doesn't work like that. Intensity is not so precise. You know, you have to train at the intensity that's right for you today and your current level, and you progress from that. I think it's just the easiest thing to overdo, and it's the easiest correction to make is make your intensive sessions appropriate for your current level, your current fatigue level, and build in room for a buffer, if you like. You know, again, intensity, your body is not a machine that has a precise threshold pace. You know, your virtual threshold, if you like, changes every day based on your fatigue, based on stress, based on environmental conditions, hydration, all kinds of things affect this, right? And you know, if you get in the zone, more or less, then you're going to get a kind of response from that. But it doesn't need to be a precise, and it doesn't need to be at the fastest part of that range. And that's what we tend to want to do. And the more we can disconnect our ego from that, the better. You know, we all know, and in coaching and even as an athlete, watching other athletes, the training champions who are, you know, they lay down in incredible sessions, but we never see anything like that from them in races. And that's a big part of why, you know, if you're pushing to the limit all the time in training, then you're not training optimally in the sense of what's likely to be sustainable for you or what's the right intensity that you can recover from consistently and over time, what's the right dose. And I came across this one concept, this like the minimal effective dose. And when I first heard that, my response was perhaps, oh, well, you know what, we shouldn't think about minimum. We should think about maximizing performance. So we can't have minimum. But over time, the concept resonated more and more, you know, in the sense of what is the minimum dose that gets us the response we want, that then if you can add on top of that, that you can do consistently over time. And I like that concept because in practice, you know, every day you can see that when's the right time to finish a session is not when you're at the limit and, you know, you're at the track and you've got to, you're laying on the track or being sick or, you know, just the feeling of being destroyed. That those are all signs you've probably exceeded the minimum dose to get the response you want. But finish feeling like you could have done more, you know, in the big picture, if you could have done 12 reps, but you do 10 of whatever, it's not a big deal. But if you exceed that point, you can run into problems. And, coming back to like the big picture, avoiding injury and illness is just fundamental to consistent improvement and achieving your potential. And what are the biggest problems that we encounter, the biggest mistakes I've made in my coaching, the biggest errors we can see is athletes that get into an injury and illness cycle. The best way to avoid future injury is right here in the present. And in fact, the best predictor of somebody that's going to be injured in the future is somebody that's had a past injury, because it can be very difficult to exit those cycles because of how good our bodies are at compensating. We end up with all kinds of secondary issues. And given sort of the typical endurance athlete mentality, you know, stubborn, reluctant to rest, athletes can end up with quite deep compensation patterns, which can be really difficult to unpick. And I think, where does that come from? It's often just from really not being disciplined with pace control, not being disciplined with management of high intensity. It's where we're most likely to go wrong. And the impact is the biggest in running, but also in cycling. There's obviously less biomechanical risk, but in the same way, it's easy to cook yourself by pushing too hard and too often. Again, perhaps slightly less in swimming, but it's all connected to the same of discipline about where you're currently at. You know, what's the right intensity for you now, and allowing yourself a range and not needing to be at the top end of that, but being quite comfortable at the lower end. And if you can't do the lower end, then you know you need to change the session and do something else, do a different kind of session. We were on the track the other day, we had an athlete that clearly wasn't quite adapting to the reps that the group was doing, and we changed the duration of the reps so that they could have more recovery. And then we continued along as an example of a modification right during a session. And, you know, the willingness and comfort level to do that, and recognizing that's not a failure of training. That's just a necessary adaptation. And in fact, that's both, I suppose, good decision-making, an example of good decision-making and what coaching is about as well. And it's not the easiest for athletes to learn how to do that. But in the right environment and reinforcement, then, you know, that's what you want to see ultimately with a self-coached athlete, is to be able to understand what's enough, when to stop, when to stop if it's not feeling right, or if the RPE is out of expectation, you know, then they're willing to stop. And I think in that sort of model, if you think about endurance sport in that model, then, I think that way of thinking is going to lead you to be more consistent over time. And, it's not about sticking to the program and you must do whatever intensity, or you have to hit your key sessions. but these are just doses of intensity that you can do or not do. But if you do the fundamentals of frequency, volume consistently, again, you know, and again, that's not over just, you know, a week or two, but over months, that's where I think you start to see that. And we know that when we look at chronic load charts as well, it's, you know, the acute load, it really does mean acute, but the chronic, you know, you can build that up over weeks and months and you can see the impact. And you also see how stable that becomes. And you know, the chronic load that a lot of us are, you know, would be thinking about may come from the training stress score model or from Power Data. And the point is perhaps not even whether that is the best way to think about it, because those are, I mean, I wouldn't say they're entirely arbitrary, but they have constants that have been decided, you know, which may not be the most valid, but the idea is still good that, you know, over, you know, a month or 2 months, your average workload over time, that's what a base or a foundation looks like, you know, a robust chronic load sets you up for success and allows you to manage intensity as well. So, you know, all of that stuff is connected, but it's all coming back to like, how do you, what I think is the most important is how do you manage those higher intensity doses, and are you getting that right?
Yeah, yeah. Again, fantastic answer. So many things that resonate there. I think that one of the things that I really want to highlight is that that thing that you said about leaving the session feeling like you could have done a couple more intros if you had wanted to, and also that it's okay to be at the lower end of that range that you're trying to hit, that you're not necessarily going for the very upper end, and you're certainly not trying to beat any given time. And that is, I guess, in my coaching, what I see as perhaps the biggest problem, is that athletes consistently try to push to get to that very upper end of a given intensity range, or trying to beat it. So that's something that that I think it's great that you highlighted there. Another follow-up question that I had is, what are your thoughts on how to place the, I guess, intense workouts during the week? How much recovery between intense workouts in different disciplines, etc. Can you talk about how you place them in the microcycle, I guess?
Yeah, I mean, we follow a fairly traditional, but it depends how, I guess, whether listeners know about the global triathlon model, but it's often around the world very similar, in that sort of Tuesdays and Saturdays end up being specific run sessions or intensive run sessions, more intense run sessions. At various times of the year, we do something on Thursday, a run off the bike or some hills or something of a smaller dose, or just easy, depending where we are now is we tend to take Thursday easy if we need to. But those 2 days and the swim, typically, again, we do usually two harder or higher intensity sessions. And with the bike as well. It depends the terrain. Like if we're in a place where there are a lot of hills or at altitude or very windy, at different times of the year, we may do one or no specific sessions because we get enough natural intensity due to those other factors. But it's often going to be two of each in each sport. And I think I find more than that is hard to sustain or is very difficult to sustain. Less than that is okay. You don't have to do up. You don't not have to do two, but yeah, we might, you know, in that model, we might we often swim a solid swim on the same day as the track session, also on a Tuesday, where the other one might be typically on a Friday, which is where it might be the only intensive session. And then the rides can be, depending on the cycle we're in, it could be Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, or Sunday. But it depends where we're at overall and in the training load. But I tried to spread them out. But I mean, that's the interesting part about triathlon is whereas only a single sport, it's much more clear or simple to spread out intensive sessions. And that's where we kind of come back to that like interaction between the three. And, you know, I know, for example, like if we do a hard, well, if we do a track session or if we do a run session the next day, depending whether we did the track session or the run session in the morning or the afternoon, the next day may not be a great swimming day to expect quality, or at least sustained quality. So, you know, as we often do Tuesday evening run session, Wednesday swim will have to be not so much of a quality session. It might be a cruise swim, endurance swim, or recovery swim as a connection to that run session.
Yeah.
I think around the cycling, it depends. It depends on the fitness level, and but it's just, you know, I guess there's different ideas about it. You can try to stack them together. You know, do, you know, like say two hard sessions on one day, and then a lighter middle day. I try to spread them out depending, but we typically take a easier Monday, and then the Tuesday some intensive sessions. Wednesday might be longer aerobic, in all three, and the Thursday depends whether we're in a specific phase or a more general phase. So spreading them out in general, I think, is useful. And I like the doing doing intensive sessions on the weekend as just a model for a rhythm going into a race. So we do both intensive sessions on Saturday and Sunday, or high workload sessions as a model for racing. So we don't have to change the microcycle when we go into a race week or out of a race week. So it's consistent in that way. You know, obviously I'm aware and thinking, you know, always thinking about different microcycles, and certainly more recently these shorter ones have become more trendy. Again, like 3-in-1 or some kind of mix of not 7-day cycles. from my side, when I look at that and experiment with that, I think I find the athletes like the predictability of, if it's a Tuesday, we do this. If it's a Wednesday, we do that. And then there's a rhythm to that. And that takes away a little bit of the uncertainty. I think that the uncertainty or the change has an energy cost. And so I look at it in that way, that predictability, the rhythm, the routine is partly how you maintain high training load, because there's a flow to things. And obviously 7-day microcycle is arbitrary, but it's arbitrary in the sense that's the way that society works. So it's not that, yeah, you know, arbitrary it's in the
built,
sense of
it's built into us from a very young age. So it's difficult, course, to change, yeah, that.
Yeah. You know, when, again, you know, so the argument goes both ways. It's like, well, why should you do a 7-day cycle and versus 4 days, you know, 3-in-1 or 8 days or something else. And I think there are perhaps not one way to do this, but my thought on this, why I've settled on this, is the predictability and the rhythm and the routine, and the practicality of places where, you know, you're dependent on facilities, on access. It's useful to have a predictable routine. And I think it's easier on the athletes when they know what to expect, you know, in partly the environment, you know, that we try to create is one where it's easier for the athletes to sustain a high workload. And partly how we do that is by providing a framework around the work that reduces their requirement to make decisions. And that's a big part of the, we're outsourcing. They don't need to decide when to show up to swim because we have it structured. It's a schedule. There's a rhythm. There's a routine to it. They know on a Tuesday, this is what to expect. This is what we do. And that flow is important, I think, to sustain over time, consistent training.
Sure. Yeah. And a final follow-up on this, on the intense sessions, what is, you've alluded to it quite a lot already, but if you can describe a little bit how you use, what sort of intensity zones you are trying to hit in the different sessions that you have in the week, like what's your preference for that?
Yeah, I mean, in the swimming, we've kind of, it's evolved over time just to be a solid hard effort. You know, it's as simple as that, and it's self-evident based on the duration of the repetitions we're doing. You know, whether if it's a longer repetition, then the intensity will be adjusted accordingly. Intensity meaning actual output speed. But you tend to just keep it really simple, like, solid. This is going to be a solid swim. We're going to swim hard. And this is the set. And you do the set according to the energy you've got. And we monitor the output and decide how much, you know, whether to change it or adapt it if they're not able to do it, or if they're slowing down or not, or if they blow up, then we can adapt that in for the swim. So it's perhaps in the end, it's all going to end up being very similar. You know, the paces don't change that much. Of course, going from off season building fitness to a stable level of fitness, then you know, the output's not going to change that much, you know, for, you know, only based on fatigue and energy is going to significantly be different. The riding, we do a lot based on group efforts. So we don't end up riding to a output, like a power output. The power will be looked at after the fact. But if we're doing hills or a group effort, last week we did a crit session, and it's just, you know, circuits with a lot of corners, and we just ride them more or less at a race intensity. And that's all we need to say. And we get what we need to out of that with a really simple description of that. When we were riding hills, we just did various different kinds of progressions building. You know, if we did six by whatever hill reps, then we almost always progress into everything that we're doing, whether it be running or cycling or swimming. Almost everything is a progression. And although that may be counterintuitive in the sense of, well, races don't start like that, they start full gas, at least in short distance racing they do. However, again, under high workload, under high fatigue, allowing the body to sort of work into it, letting the athlete to work into it, I think gets the best results in the end. I mean, in the sense of what kind of output could we get on any given day, allowing the athlete to sort of build into it, find their rhythm, find their pace, and finish the best we can, or according to the goal of the session is the most effective way to do that. I think you're most likely going to hit the sweet spot of, in terms of what the athlete could do, the right amount, if you do it like that. Especially under high fatigue. If you ask them to do high intensity right from the beginning, they may crack physically or mentally earlier than, and you will end up with having less work done than you might otherwise. So almost everything we do as a progression. And I think it tends towards also, how do we want to race? We want to finish well. We want to be in control and be strong at the end. And it's probably a good mental model from that point of view. But coming back to the running is where it's a little different. The running, we always have pace controls, and it's usually speed limits. Again, the biggest problem we have is just going too fast. So almost every session we do, we'll run to a pace range or a speed limit. So no faster than whatever per K or per 400 if we're on the track or shorter. And again, that doesn't change that much. And we know more or less we're going to get the right amount of work from that approach. So that's where it's different. The running is different than the others, where we can have more of a perceived effort output. And from the running, I want them to manage that and be more disciplined about that, because of the risks of overdoing it are higher. So we tend to, and that doesn't even change that much over time. In fact, we repeat a lot of the exact same sessions and progressions year after year. And even as the athletes get a bit faster, I mean, because there's ways to manage that as well. If you're running in a group, you know, there's the difference between setting the pace and following the pace is enough that it can make a difference. For different, slightly different levels of athletes. But I mean, that we sort of, you know, the athletes converge on the demands of the race. So in terms of pacing, obviously we don't want athletes to be running with a group but overexerting themselves relative to the others, that's a training error that we try to avoid, although it's difficult because ego gets caught up into that. So we usually the way around that is to have a plan from the beginning to manage that, rather than let the athlete sort of feel it out. Like seeing how it goes is not always the best policy with running. It's better to say, let's start at this pace and let's see where we can increase from there. But this is, and with the goal of achieving, a slightly faster pace as we're working through the whatever session it is. So where I started with that some years ago, I think was, I haven't looked at it in years since then, but using the Daniel's running formula and the VDOT as sort of a mental model for that. If I don't know if everyone's familiar with that.
Most of them are. It's been mentioned several times, and we can link to it in the show notes as well.
Sure, yeah. I mean, VDOT roughly equivalent to like a VO2 max, which could be correlated to PBs across various distances. It's not exactly that, but close enough. And according to VDOT, then you'll have pace ranges for different intensities. So, it's standard, I suppose, in the sense of zones, training zones, to elicit whatever response you're after. It tend to work primarily, when I think of where's the biggest volume coming, it's under race pace. Over volume under race pace tend to be where we spend a little bit more of our time, because again, I think under high chronic load and under high fatigue, that's probably the least risky type of work. And then when we go to the track, we tend to run over pace, but obviously under volume. So what we almost never do is sort of the stereotype 10 by a K at 10K race pace. And the thought with that is just that's the highest kind of workload session that you would tend to do in terms of the most specific. But doing that kind of session in the context of your quote unquote 30 hours a week is really difficult. In the same way that doing sort of VO2 max work in the context of middle high chronic load period is really difficult to execute without really high risk. And in fact, they may not be able to do it because they may be too fatigued to do that. So pace control and I think it's useful to be comfortable running over race pace biomechanically. You don't want that to become a limiter, but I wouldn't want to overemphasize that either. I come across stories all the time and sessions that other coaches and athletes tell me that are just substantially faster than anything I would have our guys do. And yet obviously those athletes are not at the performance level the same as some of the guys in our environment, but yet they're doing intensity that's higher and higher speed and higher workload than we would do. I think, again, some of that comes back to where we started in the whole context of what's interesting about the top athletes is that they can do the kind of intensity and a level of workload of intensity within the context of the high chronic load. Anybody, quote unquote, anybody can do high intensity under low chronic load. That's not interesting to me. It's what they can do under high load sustainably. That's where the differentiators come into play. And where you can see the difference. So, in my experience, again, over time, when we're talking about intensity, the best athletes in the world are not the ones that are doing the most, necessarily the ones that are doing the most impressive sessions. So you could walk onto the track and you could see whatever sessions anywhere from, Brownlee's to Whitfield back in Canada to anybody, you name them. The sessions in often are not something that you think is just, extraordinarily fast. That's not the point. It's can you do that session when you're highly fatigued consistently? That type of output. And that's where very quickly you see most athletes can't, and that's what the differentiator is.
Mm, yeah, great points. Can you just clarify, because I was still a bit unclear on when you said about under race pace, or I guess you meant faster than race pace when you go to the track and do running, but you still have that speed limit, so it's not like incredibly fast. But then did you say that on the swim and the bike you do more of like at race pace or slower than race pace, but you try to do more volume, or did I get that wrong? Because I wasn't quite clear on that.
I guess what I'm saying, that the precision of the way that we set up the sessions is for running is about speeds and paces, and for cycling and swimming we tend to use more subjective measures.
Yeah.
So yeah. Just hard or solid, or race effort, mid race effort, we could say, because the dynamics are different in this
yeah.
pool. You know, I think going by effort, because the day to day variation of speed is going to be slightly more due to the impact of fatigue on mechanics. So, you know, you can have a good session holding 110s, or it can be a good session holding 106s. And one of them is going to be because they were more fresh than the other. It doesn't necessarily mean that they didn't do a good session in either case.
Yeah. And what's your preference for the kind of, I guess, total duration of the main set in the swim? Like, do you do like the faster, like 1,000 meter main sets, or do you like to do longer main sets with 2,000 to 3,000 meter main sets? And same for the bike. You mentioned 6 repetitions on hills. Is that 6 times 3 minutes or 6 times 10 minutes? Like, or do you mix it up and really have from both sides of the spectrum?
Yeah, I tend to follow just a progression also over time. So in the beginning of the, you know, when we're ready to start intensity, we'll do a smaller volume of intensity, and then we'll gradually increase that volume of intensity until a certain point. Doesn't continue forever. It depends how, you know, in the swim it could be, you know, as little as, you know, 400 meters of hard swimming at the beginning to, you know, 2 to 3 Ks main set of a variety of paces or consistent solid. I mean, probably we wouldn't do much more than that of a main set, all solid or all hard effort, but in that range. We don't have a lot of fluff in our sets. We always do the same warm up. We do 800, then we do some kind of preset, and then we'll have a main set of between 2 and 4 K, and then a cool down. So there's not a lot of extras in there in terms of volume or easy swimming, but just long main sets, I think, is the key to triathlon swimming. Don't fluff around too much with a lot of different things, and probably for age groupers as well. Like, you know, if you got an hour to swim, make the most of that hour. Don't spend too much time doing, you know, non-specific things. I think, you know, in general, you know, and that's a difference perhaps between sort of master's programs or you know, club swimming, where there's, you know, they're going to be in there for 2 hours. They can't do 2 hours of main sets. They end up having a lot of fluff. And this, I don't think is very effective in triathlon because we enter in such a typically a fatigued state or pre-fatigued state from whatever we did the day before or the same day. I don't think that sort of the extra mileage in the pool is always of value, because you can end up just swimming technically poor as a result. So that's perhaps counterproductive for triathlon swimming. But yeah, so and the cycling, it depends if it's a solo session or if it's a group session, and there's the dynamics of a group, like we did a bunch effort where we had 5 guys rotating through for a period of time. You know, that you can't really, I mean, we just give it a label like mid-race effort, you know, so not the beginning, but once you settle in, what is that? And they know more or less what the power output's going to be, you know, so they know how to do that. I mean, obviously these guys are very experienced in this way, but it doesn't need to be more specific than that. We don't say, well, you've got to achieve a certain output. It depends on the wind, it depends on the hills. Depends how they're feeling. You know, the interaction between the athletes, they, you know, if they, some might need to sit in a couple of turns and others might take longer, longer pulls. So often for cycling, again, it's more on RPE or according to the effort that we want to do. But, you know, if we're doing it like a progression, session, a couple of weeks ago, we were doing long climbs. It was about 15-minute climbs. We did three, and we just said, let's progress from the first to the third. And so, the athlete can figure out what's the best way to do that based on their energy levels and using the other guys to push themselves. And I know if, as long as they don't start too hard, we're going to achieve more or less what we want then. And so that's close enough. That's keeping it simple enough and kind of in a way to avoid making an error in the sense of an athlete blowing up or having a session where their confidence is knocked because they tried to do too much. You know, that's a, I suppose, thing that we didn't talk about, but it's all connected to this, is trying to set up sessions to be successful, to be perceived as successful, is really important. Because, you know, athletes, if you give them a session, they assume that you're giving it to them because you think that they can do it. And so if they can't do it, then, you know, they think that they failed, where actually probably, you know, 99% of the time it's the coach that's failed because they've failed to anticipate what was possible on the day. And, but the athlete is the one that ends up feeling bad about that often, right? I couldn't do what the coach said, what the coach thought I could do. So I failed somehow, therefore my confidence is down, or, I couldn't do what the coach thought I needed to be able to do. Which is also an error in thinking. You know, we get that wrong more than the athletes do. It's particularly, you know, if we're thinking about the context of coaches working with adults who have chosen to do what they're doing. You know, they're typically highly motivated people. In probably the majority of coaching contexts, the athletes we're working with have self-selected that they're already motivated. And we always have to assume high motivation, even when they're fatigued. Of course, that affects generally our acute motivation, but they're still highly motivated people. So we always have to assume that they want to do whatever it is that, you know, you set the objective as. So I think it's partly also our job in connecting all of this is to anticipate what they ought to be able to do, given everything you know about the context, the chronic load, the acute load, what you know about the profile of the athlete. We want to set them up to be successful in their program. So I think also how we think about prescribing work, it should be according to what we believe they can do in order to build up their confidence as well. And in an authentic way, we're not trying to falsely build their confidence, but we want them to be successful in their training. And we can do that by anticipating what they can do on any given day. I suppose that's what we do when we write a program. We think, what can they do? At least that's one way to look at it. What can they do this week? What should they be able to do on this Tuesday, knowing we're week five in this cycle of progression? And that means, you know, when I think about that, I think that's also saying that the workouts needn't always get harder or bigger, because over time, just doing the same amount of work, the same workload in any particular day is, you know, still, it's a good thing. You know, if they can consistently do the same workload over 5-6 weeks in a row, under ever increasing chronic load, you know, that's also a context to improvement. So it doesn't need to always get harder and faster, you know, in that way. I think if you're thinking of endurance training in this model, overload can be from a chronic way, or overload in the sense of too much load, but building chronic load, what's the stimulus to improve? It's that progression over time, but it doesn't need to be progression in that every week has to be longer or faster or harder than the week before. that's actually not that's not sustainable. So that's when you reach this sort of sweet spot for how much work you can do, what can you do consistently, and you vary that according to how they seem to be adapting and managing. And the better you get at that process, the more likely that you can predict what they're going to be able to do so that they feel successful and they feel they're able to do what you think that they can do. And hopefully over time they learn to, where confidence should come from is, when we talk about process and trusting the process and buying into this process, that they know if they do this work over time, then they're going to maximize their rate of improvement and they're going to have the most predictable performance when they want to. Instead of, a different model is continuing to test them over time, but doing that, not being so confident in your own process. I mean, that's part of it. And then also breaking the consistency. That's the other side of kind of the test model, the interrupt the chronic load to test, is not, in my view, it's not trusting your own process in order to get the outcomes that you want.
Yeah. Okay, so I'm ready to move on to the rapid fire questions. But before we do you have anything else that we haven't talked about that that you want to add? This has been really great, and we've been going on for a long time. And I've actually skipped quite a lot of the questions and topics that I wrote down. But what we've covered so far has been absolutely fantastic. But if there's anything that we missed that you think would be important to convey, this is your chance to do so.
just thinking a couple of points and maybe rapid fire on this. I think brick workouts from the point of view of time efficiency for age groupers, good. Brick workouts from the point of view of necessary to run faster off the bike, not so important. I think there's not actually a lot that we're training that's different there. I find running off the bike the very first time of the year, the athletes can go as fast as they could ever want to go. I don't think we're really training anything there other than psychology, which is not insignificant, but that is something to think about. And then peaking, I think we just way overdo considering peaking from a performance point of view for any level of athlete. I think just being consistently aerobically fit and a stable level of conditioning is going to get you almost everything that you could want in sport, rather than trying to shoot for the extra one, the proverbial 1%, I think is not necessary to achieve top performance in sport. I think we want predictable, stable performances. And so much of the time, showing up to the start line healthy, with energy, not having cooked yourself, is like 99% of performing to what you could hope from yourself, rather than hoping or expecting for something that you've never done before because you've pushed, typically push too hard. So I like the concept of let's just try to get stable, consistent, and predictable performances and not worry too much about peaking.
Great perspectives. All right. So rapid fire questions, 15 seconds or less to answer these. And the first one is, what's your favorite book, blog, or resource related to triathlon or endurance sports?
I don't have something immediate, but the starting point, I think, would be reading back some Arthur Lydiard concept for running and applying that to triathlon. So there's some quite old books about that, Running to the Top. There's even one about adapting that for swimming, which to me resonated a lot and something I sometimes come back to.
What's a personal habit that's helped you achieve success?
I think just being as committed as the athletes. You got to walk the talk, and if you talk about commitment, you've got to demonstrate that. And I think that's what we do, sort of living and training together throughout the year.
And who's somebody in triathlon that you look up to?
I think with a young sport like ours, when I think of who I looked up to, it's actually the athletes that I get the opportunity to work with, and I'm perhaps somewhat unique in that respect to get to learn from some top athletes, but when I think of all the different athletes from Simon Whitfield to many of the British athletes to the athletes who I've got now, those are the people in triathlon that I look up to in the sense that have learned the most from.
Perfect. And finally, where can people follow you and what you have going on?
we're trying to share a lot of the everyday process. I use Instagram, so if you look up Joel Filial on Instagram, stories, what we're doing. We've made some videos here about our training. We're experimenting with that, but I mean, we tend to focus on just doing the job of coaching every day. But I've got a YouTube channel with some videos that we've made. And follow the podcast, all of that linked on my personal website, joelfilial.com. And I like when people send in questions, and general enthusiasm keeps me motivated to set aside time to revive the podcast and hopefully keep it going.
Yeah, the name of the podcast is The Real Coaching Podcast, so people can find it, but we'll also link to that. And as you said, it's on your website as well. Thank you so much, Joel. It was a real pleasure, and thank you so much for your generous use of time for us tonight. It was fantastic to talk to you.
Thanks for having me. Enjoyed the chat.
All right, so I really, really hope that now you understand why I was so excited when I introduced this interview to you. For me, this is definitely one of those very few interviews that I know that I will go back and listen to again and again and again, because there's just so much value, so much fantastic advice in it. And I'm not going to pick out any key takeaways, because I think that everything that we discussed here are key takeaways, really, because all of these things are the fundamental things that you need to get right, nailing the basics, so to say. And so it's, I don't want to highlight one thing above another. I just want to say, go back and listen to it one time, two times, three times, and go to the show notes page as well. Go to thattriathlonshow.com and click through to this specific episode and read through that. And just, I guess, take a few moments to sit down and think about what you heard, and if there's anything that you might change in your training as a result of all of this advice that we heard. If you are new to the podcast and you want to make sure that you get all the new episodes as they are released, remember, we have episodes every Monday and Thursday, then please subscribe to the show so that you don't miss anything. And if you have been with us for a long, long time and you love this show and you love interviews like this, then please consider leaving a rating and review, because that really helps a lot and helps me keep doing this this show and keep doing it consistently. I try to be as consistent with the podcast as we all should be with our training, as discussed in this interview. But those ratings and reviews, they really do help, because without growing the show, it would be very difficult to warrant the time that it really is required to put out two episodes per week. So if you enjoy the show, please leave a rating and review on iTunes or your podcast app, whichever app you're using. Finally, massive thank you to our sponsors that keep the show going. First, we have Roka, that you can find on roka.com. Get 20% off your entire order by using the promo code THATTRIATHLONSHOW, all one word, all caps. You can use that for wetsuits, tri suits, any triathlon or swim apparel, eyewear, performance sunglasses, the fantastic R1 goggles, and many other things that I've talked about in past episodes as well. So check it out on roka.com. And thank you to Precision Hydration, that you can find on precisionhydration.com. Remember to go and take that free online sweat test to get your individual hydration strategy for racing, but it also includes some great advice for how to use the product in training. And they have a great blog as well, with lots of great content, quite detailed and in-depth content. So I really like Precision Hydration's blog. You can get your first box of Precision Hydration product for free when you use the promo code THATTRIATHLONSHOW, all one word, all caps. Thank you, as always, for listening. Keep training smart and keep loving triathlon.